guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And at this time, we begin the TechNet, as we've done most Sunday evenings for the last 32, 33 years since 1982. I guess it's more than 34 years. The main purpose of the TechNet, for those who haven't heard it before, is to pass information to educate each other about this very educational hobby called ham radio. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. So if you're displeased with this hobby before you abandon it, try one of the other 25. Let me drop it. Try to remember to leave a gap in between your transmissions before you pick up. We hear all four beeps so that the machine thoroughly becomes reset the way it's supposed to. People sign into the TechNet because they do have a question or a comment. They sign in by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. Try to remember to give me your call letters and your name after waiting for the four beeps before you begin that transmitting. You need not sign in because you're listening. After 34 years, we're positive somebody is listening. By way of the internet and IRLP connections, there are people living outside of the area of the tri-state area that this repeater covers, which are also being heard by this repeater. And occasionally we get check-ins from Canada and Mexico, and I think we've had a check-in from the Caribbean once. And in theory, we could get a check-in from Europe if a person is up at those particular hours. So at this time, if you do have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes right now. K2RIW, listening.
B2GXM, Rich, and yes.
This is AC2IS, Bill, yes.
So far we have Rich and Bill. And by the way, 2 weeks ago, Andy, Kilo Delta 2, Mike Tango Papa, signed in. But we didn't get a chance to get to him because we had those great big discussions on the new television that Eric was telling us about. In the next couple of years, your current television set is going to become obsolete and it's going to have to be replaced because the United States is going over to a new standard for digital television. So that was such exciting material. We got into that and never got to Andy. So if Andy checks in tonight, Kilo Delta 2 Mike Tango Papa, we'll put him at the top of the list since he didn't get his chance to be heard 2 weeks ago. As I said, we've got Rich and Bill signed in so far. Anyone else check in with it? Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes right now. K2RIW.
KC2WGD with a question on an antenna if you have time, Dick.
Oh, very fine, John. And antennas are my favorite subject. We'll definitely have time for that one. And glad to hear you back. One last call. Anyone else to give me your call letters and name at this time for a check-in? K2RIW.
K6CPZ with a quickie master's check.
And WS2N Paul with a space report. Good evening. Good evening, John.
And Paul will be giving us the space report number 241. And this is TechNet number 1641 of the series. Okay, Rich, you're first. WB2GXM. How are those electrons treating you tonight? Go ahead, Rich, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
The quick answer is yes or no.
K2RIW and the group, WB2GXM. First, John, welcome back. We missed you. I missed you. Okay, this is a public service announcement of sorts. Radio Shack is closing its remaining stores on Long Island. Radio Shack will be gone, gone, gone. Stuff is discounted heavily. That's my comment. K2RIW, WB2GXM.
So, Rich, you have evidence that they've already begun very deep sales, cuts, or large discounts on items that are still left in the store? What have you seen when you visit Radio Shack stores these days? And roughly what percentage of them are still left on Long Island? Are half of them still there, and they're all going out of business? And are they going out of business in a week, a month, or 2 months? What's your guess on all of that, Rich? That would be through GXM. K2IW in the TechNet. Thank you for the info.
There's only one store near me now. There used to be about 10. The one remaining near me is in Garden City. I was there Saturday. I was there Sunday. I was very bad, but I also cleaned up. Store manager tells me they're going to be definitely gone by the end of March.
Now, you said you were very bad, Rich. What does that mean? You bought everything in sight and you bought it for 10 cents on the dollar? What do you mean by very bad? I can't believe you were very bad. Go ahead, Rich.
Yes, Dick, I was very bad. I spent a few hundred dollars this weekend. But, you know, hey, it's not going to be there anymore. It's just not going to be there. So I justified that. Anyway, it's only money. K2RIWWB2GXM.
Give us a hint as to some of the kinds of materials you bought when you were so bad. Did you buy cell phones, television sets, adapters? What did you buy, Rich? Go ahead.
Well, I bought a Bluetooth headset that looked good. But the most intriguing thing was a Bluetooth transmitter and a Bluetooth receiver, both audio, separate units. I hadn't seen that before. That's going to come in handy in the ham shack. And a 13.8 volt power supply and a lot of breadboards and PC boards that I could use later. K2RIW, WP2GXM.
Sounds very good there, Rich. In the case of the Bluetooth transmitter and receiver, I guess that allows you to make a link across the shack, through the house, and whatever. And that's primarily audio, although maybe it'll cover data. Got a guess as to what kind of range that Bluetooth transmitter and receiver has? Back to you, Rich.
It says 30 feet. And I might try that out. Anyway, the transmitter is destined for the ham shack, and the receiver will move around all over the rest of the house. It's going to be very handy.
Very nice. And I think Bluetooth transmits on the 802.11 set of frequencies, around 2.4 gigahertz. Is that true? Go ahead.
You're on that one, Dick. Anyway, I'll let you know how it goes. But anyone else listening, get over there if you're interested, because this is not going to last. K2RIW, WB2GXM.
Bluetooth is 2.4 gigs, Dick.
Thank you, Eric. And one last question, Rich. From your experience at the Garden City store, I think it was, is half the stuff still left, or is 70% of the stuff already gone? Give us a rough guess on that one, Rich.
The good news is this announcement came out only yesterday. The store was not even crowded. I had free rein of the whole place all weekend. I don't know how long that's going to last.
Good to know. And give us a feedback in the future weeks as to how the Bluetooth works and how fast the stuff is disappearing from the store. And by the way, Radio Shack completely going out of business. Was that announced over the airways, or you found out because you were in the store? How did you find out about it, Rich? Go ahead.
A friend of mine told me about it, so I took him at his word, and I was glad I did. K2RW in the group, WB2GXM.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
That's the same thing, except it was on CBS radio. I listened to that a lot and said that they were going to be closing, liquidating everything. Somebody else is buying it up, apparently, and then they're just going to liquidate it. I don't know who that somebody is. But I heard a quick report. I think it was yesterday. Like he said, probably yesterday morning or something. Back to you.
Okay, so it has been publicly announced. Thank you, Paul. Okay, William, AC2IS. What would you like to talk about tonight? I'll discuss anything except antennas. That's a joke. You've got it, Bill.
Yes, sadly, my question is the same one as last week, exactly about antennas. I just wanted to have a brief recap of the discussion of horizontal separation of antennas. I believe that I did hear somebody say that for horizontal separation, you should separate antennas by a quarter wave. My understanding is that if the other antenna is in a different band, that might be fine. But if it's in the same band, then you've essentially, that's near field, and the other antenna would essentially become part of the first antenna. Is that correct, AC2IS?
It's close to correct, Bill. There's more to the story. With horizontal separation of vertically polarized antennas, whip antennas, for instance, at the same altitude, if you're putting one on the front right fender of the car and one on the rear left-hand corner of the car, they have a certain horizontal separation. And once you get out of the first couple of feet from a 2-meter or 450 antenna, then it will obey inverse square law. Every foot or every time you double the distance between the antennas, the isolation between the two will increase by 6 dB. 6 dB per octave is normal inverse square law. So after you get a few feet from the antennas, they follow inverse square law. There is no magic distance. Quarter wavelength, half wavelength, three times quarter wavelength, five times half wavelength. There is no magic distance. It falls off by inverse square law when they're on the same frequency. When the two antennas are on different frequencies, the coupling between the two is extremely light as far as transmitting characteristics are concerned. In other words, if I had a 2-meter Yagi on my mast, horizontally polarized, and a 450 Yagi, horizontally polarized, on the same mast, they're both horizontal polarized, and I've got them vertically separated by 1 foot. The coupling between the two is extremely light because they're on different frequencies. You measure the transmission characteristics of the 2-meter antenna with and without the 450 there. You will not see any difference in pattern, gain, whatever. Yes, there will be a fairly strong 2-meter signal coming into the 450 antenna as far as another receiver is concerned. If that 450 receiver didn't have a fairly good front-end filter, the amount of signal it's getting on 2 meters might be enough to create front-end overload and some funny receiver characteristics.
Repeater, timeout.
Transmitter-wise, that there would be no real problems. So, now, if the antennas are vertically polarized and they're being vertically stacked along a mast or along a tower, then life gets a hell of a lot easier. Every vertically polarized antenna has a null in its pattern off of the ends, and two vertically polarized antennas stacked at different altitudes on a tower, the null of one is looking at the null of the other, and the amount of coupling is going to be extremely light, and they can be very close. And there are some commercial installations where the two antennas are very close to each other and work like a charm, even though they're on the exact same frequency. Still, when it comes to cross-coupling between the antennas, there's two ways of looking at it. One, is it affecting transmitter pattern, gain, and reception equivalent area? And the answer is, with vertical stacking and vertical polarization, there's almost no problem. However, the amount of signal it takes to overload a receiver is a hell of a lot lighter than the amount of signal that would change a pattern gain or gain change, if you know what I mean. So you may still get some problems of trying to transmit out of one while receiving on the other on slightly different frequencies within the same band, and that could be troublesome. AC2IS for some more questions. K2I, Zebnet TechNet. You got a Bill?
Yeah. I think you were saying that in the case of vertical stacking, Well, something that you didn't say, unless I missed it, is in order to figure out distance between antennas when you're vertically stacking, vertically polarized antennas, you should sort of figure out the theoretical length of, I guess, a full-wave antenna or a full dipole, and regardless of the size of your actual antenna, you should assume that it's that big, and I guess sort of expand around the sort of center of mass of your actual physically smaller antenna, assume it's larger, and then give you yourself some separation between that and the virtual, say if it's a 2 meter antenna, 2 meter size of the next antenna, so that their capture areas do not overlap. So what additional spacing should you give there? Should it be a few inches, a few feet, a few fractions of a wavelength? But you give an answer to that, AC2IS.
Hello, my friend.
In the case of a vertical station master-like antenna, which already is multiple wavelengths long, and its mass center is somewhere in the middle of that 15-foot length, a pair of them vertically stacked. Your main reason for separating them is you don't want the tip of one touching the bottom of the other. You could stack them almost that close, and they would work. So the original capture areas and the overlapping of the capture areas only has meaning if you're using the pair of antennas on the exact same frequency simultaneously as a phased array. So if I decide to use a power divider and feed the two vertically stacked, vertically polarized station masters on my tower, and I'm feeding both of them with equal lengths of transmission line, and I'm doing that in order to get 3 dB more gain, and I'm going to get an even sharper pancake pattern if I do that. You could do that. You have to be a little bit careful with the mechanics, but in that case, your major separation would be a mechanical separation. You don't want touching the other. So there is no magic quarter wave, half wave, overlapping of spacing. The overlapping of the effective capture areas only has meaning if the two antennas are on the exact same frequency at the exact same period of time. Let me drop. The craziness about the way an antenna acquires its effective capture area, it does that over some number of cycles. If I've got two vertically stacked, vertically polarized, station master-like antennas, we'll say, I'm using one at 146.2, I'm using one at 147.2, into two separate pieces of equipment. I can talk about the effective capture area of the first one and the effective capture area of the second one. If I look at that naively, I would say, hey, those two areas are overlapping each other if I've got them stacked as close as I can where the tip of one doesn't touch the bottom of the other. Those effective capture areas are only there after a whole bunch of cycles of that particular frequency. Because in my example, they're on different frequencies, the effective areas do not overlap. The effective area on 146.7, when I'm using the antenna on the bottom at 146.2 and 147.2, the effective area of one doesn't interfere with the other because they're not on the same frequency. I know that sounds crazy. So only if you're making a phased array out of them do you have to worry about the areas overlapping. The main reason we create separation is we want some number of decibels of decoupling between the two so that the power out of one doesn't blast the front end of the other receiver and possibly create damage or possibly create a front end overload and so on. When it comes to how strong the signal is on the other antenna, it's strictly a function of distance and inverse square law. Every time you double the distance, the amount of signal between the two is going to get 6 dB weaker. AC2IS, K2LIW, go ahead, Bill.
Okay, so when you say stacked antennas, does that imply a phased array? Because that's not what I'm talking about. That's not the use case I'm concerned about. So it sounds like what you're saying is that if the antennas are, you know, less than a full wave long, if they're, say, quarter wave antennas, you can separate them by, say, maybe an inch vertically, just as long as they're not touching and not overlapping, and that would be fine. And, you know, say if one is on 145 megahertz and the other is on 145.4, you still don't have to worry about the capture areas overlapping. Is that correct, AC2IS?
Yes, that's correct, Bill. Now, you do have to worry about the fact that when you've got them that close together, the amount of signal getting from one to the other might be, let me pick a number, 20 dB of isolation. If one is running 100 watts and you got 20 dB of isolation, 20 dB down from 100 watts is 1 watt. So when you're transmitting out of one, the other antenna is going to be receiving 1 watt of power, in my example. And whether or not your front end can tolerate that without damage is a little bit questionable. And by the way, if you have any doubt as to what is the amount of isolation between the two antennas, a simple signal generator test will tell you that. You put a signal generator into one and measure the power coming out of the other with a power meter, a spectrum analyzer, a crystal detector in a scope, whatever. And the fact that you measure the isolation at the milliwatt level and you want to know the isolation at the 100-watt level, in my example, doesn't matter. Everything is linear. If you've got 20 dB of separation between the two antennas, 20 dB of isolation, no matter what power level you put into them, you're going to have 20 dB of isolation. And so, therefore, you can measure and therefore calculate how much of your signal from one gets to the other. Whether or not that equipment can tolerate it, is that a function of how good is the filtering of the front end of the other one, how high is the dynamic range, and so on. So, as you can see, by the way, let me drop this. I should also tell you that the word stacking is an ambiguous word in the vocabulary of ham radio operators, not so much with antenna people. When a deep antenna person is talking about stacking of antennas, usually he's talking about a phased array where all the antennas are being fed simultaneously on the same frequency. We amateurs talk about stacking, meaning they're on the same mast, they're on the same roof, they're on the same tower. We call that stacking, whether they're being used on the same frequency or on different frequencies. So there's ambiguity in those words. So if a person says, I'm stacking antennas, you might have to ask him some more questions to find out what is he really discussing. Well, when the antennas are on different bands, you can get away with murder, obvious by the fact that you and I can buy Yagi antennas, the Finco 6 and 2 is the first one I know about, way back in the 1960s. A 6-meter Yagi and a 2-meter Yagi on the same boom simultaneously, and they work like a charm. AC2IS, K2IW, the TechNet.
Okay, thank you for that answer. And let me know when I might be monopolizing the airwaves here, otherwise I might just keep on going. But what would be a better term to use, a less ambiguous term than stacking, in order to purposely decide that you're not doing a phased array of antennas? And also, I believe you mentioned a formula last week, which was, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, especially on the units here, but 36.6 dB plus 20 log frequency in megahertz plus 20 log distance in meters, I think, gives you isolation in dB between two antennas. It seems like, you know, if you have vertically polarized antennas and they're, you know, six wavelengths apart and they're horizontally separated versus they're six wavelengths apart and they're vertically separated, would give you different answers. What is this equation assuming? Is it assuming horizontal separation? AC2IS.
Okay, you've got one factor wrong in that formula, Bill. 36.6 decibels plus 20 times log of F in megahertz plus 20 times log of D in miles, not meters, miles. So it's frequency in megahertz, distance in miles, Both of them have a 20 log of that factor in front of them added together, plus 36.6. That's the total number of decibels of isolation between two isotropic antennas. If the antennas have 0 dB of gain, they transmit in all directions at once. That's the theoretical isotropic antenna, a very good reference antenna. And a quarter wave whip comes close to that that amount of gain, and you're going to fall off by 60 dB per octave distance. That formula tells you what happens, but as Joe found out to be to RYY a week or two ago, when you get super close, when you get close enough, when the calculated loss turns out to be less than, let me pick a number, 10 dB. If you use that formula with distance in miles, frequency in megahertz, and you hit the 36.6, and you calculate an amount of loss that's 10 dB or less, rough rule of thumb, you can no longer trust the formula. Because as you start getting down to, let me pick a number, inches and feet of separation, at say, for instance, 6 meters, 2 meters, you'll calculate an amount of loss that's not a positive number in decibels of loss to come up with a negative number. To come up with appears to be gain. Let me drop. When you get super close to an antenna, where you're inside of the reactive near field, instead of the signal falling off 6 dB per octave, range squared, it starts becoming range cubed, fourth, fifth, and so on. You get some crazy characteristics. You get direct capacitive coupling. So the curve of loss versus distance becomes a nonlinear curve, not a straight line on log paper anymore, when you get super close. And so the crazy way you're starting to get transformer action and capacitive coupling action between the antennas. It's no longer a radiated field anymore. The formula breaks down. So you calculate less than 10 dB of loss, don't trust the formula. Beyond that, the formula is good for any kind of antenna. That tells you free space loss. Let me drop. If you use that formula and you plug in the number of 1 mile on 2 meters, I don't know the exact number, but you might come up with 85 dB of loss. Free space loss, 1 mile, 2 meters, isotropic antennas. And now you know that your transmitting antenna has 10 dB of gain. That's a Yagi aimed at the other one. And the other antenna has 6 dB of gain aimed at the first one. So the two antennas are aimed at each other. 10 dB of gain out of one, 6 dB of gain out of the other, 16 dB of gain. You take that loss number, whatever you just calculated for isotropic, and subtract the 16 dB. So the formula tells you isotropic loss, whether they're horizontally stacked, vertically stacked, horizontally polarized, vertically polarized. The formula is telling you what the loss is, assuming you're talking about the same polarization. The formula is not going to give you the right loss if the first antenna is horizontally polarized and the second antenna is vertically polarized. Now the insertion loss is a function of isotropic loss we just calculated plus the polarization decoupling loss that you would add to it. So in that case, you'd add decoupling loss because of cross polarization. Maybe one is 45 degrees away from the other. Let me drop. So you'd be adding the extra loss because of depolarization coupling. You have the two antennas 45 degrees apart, for instance. That gives you 3 dB of extra depolarization loss. The antenna you're listening to me out of right now is a Yagi that's aimed at it's polarized at a 45 degree angle, halfway between the horizontal and the vertical people. I can talk to both. So I've got a depolarization loss of 3 dB because I've got a 45 degree angle of polarization compared to everybody else. I would add that to the free space loss. But if my antenna has got 10 dB of gain, I subtract the 10 dB of gain. So the formula tells you ISO, and you add these other two factors, depolarization and gain of the antennas. Does that make some sense, Joe? Bill, so you do it three steps, so to speak. Free space loss, add or subtract the gain. By the way, your antenna could be a lossy antenna. It was a tau bar antenna at the low end of its frequency range where it has 20 dB below isotropic gain. In that case, I would calculate free space loss and then add another 20 dB of loss because the antenna is running at negative gain. because it's a Talabara antenna, for instance. Do you see the process, I think, Bill? AC2IS, K2IW the TechNet. Good question. Ask another one if you want to. We got some time tonight.
Okay, yeah, that was a very clear answer. I should apply the gain or loss as appropriate, depending on the antenna pattern of the various antennas. So I guess my next question then will be, if I quote-unquote violate the rules here and place another antenna in near field of the first antenna, can I make some general assumptions, like if I did place my two antennas a quarter wave apart, can I make some basic assumptions about how I'm affecting the antenna pattern of the transmitting antenna, AC2IS?
If I had a 2-meter Yagi, horizontally polarized on my mast, and I take a 450 Yagi, horizontally polarized, mounted on the same mast, and I separate the two by 1 foot, the mechanism by which one antenna would affect the other is that the 450 antenna, Yagi, its elements are shorter, but they're lying fairly close to these longer elements of the 2-meter Yagi. There's going to be some extra capacitive coupling between the tips of the 450 and the elements of the 2-meter. That extra capacitive coupling is going to tune those individual elements a little bit lower in frequency. And that's the mechanism by which you might get some gain and pattern change of the 450. The 2-meter antenna doesn't even see the 450 antenna. It's not there, because its elements are so short that it's only near the center of each of the 2-meter elements. But the 450 is going to experience a little bit of decoupling, a little bit of detuning, because of the close capacitive coupling. That Finco 6 and 2 antenna with the 6-meter elements and 2-meter elements on the same boom, the 2-meter elements saw some extra capacitive coupling from the 6-meter elements. The manufacturer readjusted the length of the higher frequency elements to compensate. Therefore, the gain came all the way back, and therefore, a 6-meter Yagi and a 2-meter Yagi on the same boom gave full performance of each Yagi once you compensate for the known effect. So you don't calculate over capture area, over overlapping areas. Let me drop it. When they're on different bands, and when they're on different frequencies, it's not an overlapping area phenomenon. It's a capacitive coupling phenomenon. And if you're smart enough, you can compensate for it, make it all come out right. So what's the closest possible stacking, vertical stacking, of, let's say, horizontally polarized antennas? In some cases, if you're smart enough, the vertical stacking can be zero. They're mounted on the exact same boom. Another crazy example. I wanted a circular polarized high-gain Yagi antenna on 432. I've got a RIW-19 elements on 432. Now, what's circular polarization? I took two Yagis, one horizontally polarized, one vertically polarized, and strapped the two booms together with only a block of wood between the two and a hose clamp wrapped around it just to make it mechanically work. And one Yagi was pushed forward a couple of inches from the other one just to make sure that the elements wouldn't touch each other, if you know what I mean. And I compensated for that extra one Yagi was a little bit closer to the target than the other, and I made that that transmission line appropriately shorter. Let me drop. So cross-polarized Yagis with the booms touching each other, no interaction between the two. And as long as I feed signals to the two Yagis simultaneously with 90 degrees of phase shift, one transmission line was a quarter wavelength longer than the other, depending which way I make longer, it generates either clockwise or counterclockwise circular polarization. So there's another example of a high-gain antenna, 19 elements, 15.5 dB of gain over dipole, being stacked at a zero spacing distance and worked like a charm. So any general rules of thumb how many wavelengths of spacing, on what frequency, and what kind of stacking and whatever. Most of these rules are naive, and there's all kinds of ways that you can break the rules and have no detriment if you're smart enough and you know what you're doing, if you ask the right questions. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks for that. That's, you're talking mainly about, you use so beam antennas, it's very tight antenna pattern. But I think in general I'm more interested in omnidirectional, vertically polarized antennas. So if I've got two antennas that are a quarter wave apart, same band, say they're 2 meters or 70 centimeters, so I'm assuming that there will be an impact on the antenna pattern in this case, and are there any assumptions I can make about that kind of a case? AC2IS.
You've got a mental picture, Bill, that you didn't tell me. You've got them quarter wavelength apart. Are they horizontally displaced, vertically displaced, quarter wavelength apart, both vertically polarized? I'm going to take the worst case. If you've got two of them at the exact same altitude, horizontally displaced by quarter wave, and they're both vertical dipoles, vertical monopoles, that's going to give you super close coupling. My guess is if you transmitted a signal into one and measured how much comes out of the other, you're going to find 7 dB of loss, so to speak. The formula for distance versus signal strength, isotropic loss, ain't going to work. In that particular case, you either use somebody else's experience because they've really done it, or you simply make the measurement. You put a signal generator into one and measure what comes out of the other. So with a quarter wavelength of spacing on 2 meters, two vertically polarized monopoles. By the way, in that particular case, the ground plane radials are not only touching each other, they're interleaved with each other. You've got a whole lot of evidence here that you've got super clear spacing. And even if one of them is being used on 146 megs and one is used on 147 megs, the coupling between the two is going to be a very low number. 7 or so dB is what I think you're going to measure by experience. And can you get away with that? Well, if you've got the right kind of relay so that you're not overloading the other guy, and if you're only radiating a watt, no problem. If you're about to put 100 watts into one antenna, the receiver connected to the other antenna is probably going to have a smoking front end. And can you receive on the other one simultaneously when the first one is transmitting? Without some very fancy duplexing filter, the answer is no. So if your back's against the wall and you don't have very much real estate to deal with, let me drop it. And you got a mount antenna super close. Even with that super close spacing, quarter wavelength of spacing, you measure the pattern out of those two antennas one at a time. The pattern will be very close to the undisturbed pattern. The radar cross-section of the other antenna is fairly small, and the amount of reflection that's going to be giving you a little bit of difference in spanning wave ratio, a little bit of difference in pattern in that direction. That's not the main factor. The cross-coupling and whether or not the electronics can tolerate it. Now, in the case of Air Force One, in the case of military vehicles like a Jeep, where you've got the 5 different whips mounted on the exact same bumper of the Jeep, and the 5 different whips are on slightly different frequencies, slightly different bands, whatever. There is a company called General Electronics, General Atomics, I'm trying to think of the name of the company, which was an AIL affiliate, a Cutler Hammer company in California, that made a fancy tuning mechanism that would create an extremely sharp null on the adjacent frequency. In other words, if one antenna is going to be used on 146 and one antenna is going to be used on 147, you connect their electronics to their those two antennas that are on the same boom, on the same bumper. These maybe were, in this particular case, these were whip antennas where each whip was, let me pick a number, 6 feet long. And they're mounted 2 feet apart. If the wind waved the whips real fast, they could touch each other. Let me drop them. With the fancy knowing electronics and adaptive knowing electronics, the two frequencies, a deep know of 50 or 60 dB on the other frequency was created on that antenna without affecting its main gain. I'll give you an example. Assume one antenna is on 50 megs and one antenna is on 51 megs. The 50 meg antenna had an extremely deep know on 51. The 51 meg antenna had an extremely deep know at 50 or 60 decibel know. As such, it was possible to transmit out of one while simultaneously receiving out of the other with essentially no degradation, no cross, no desensitization, no intermodulation distortion. The actual coupling between the two antennas was probably 2 dB. They created 60 dB of null with the fancy electronic filtering-like devices that they added to them. So there's an example of what you would think on paper is impossible. They did it. And that company sold a lot of them for certain military applications. And Air Force One at one time had a series of those because a lot of antennas were on that same fuselage operating on various bands simultaneously. AC2IS, K2RIW. Isn't it amazing what you can get away with if you're smart enough? Over to you, Bill.
Question.
Okay, Bill first, and then we'll pick up questions. Go ahead, Bill.
This is AC2IS. So, yeah, judging by your answer, the antenna pattern is not going to be appreciably changed, but you have to figure out if you're going to desense or damage the other radio involved. So, I guess with typical, what I'm going to call typical for the moment, being, say, 50-watt mobile gear. Sorry, maybe let the other questioner pick up for a second, and I'll come back. AC2IS.
Yeah, those two whip antennas mounted on the same bumper of this Jeep, a couple of feet apart. And the whip antennas themselves are multiple feet long. You would assume the pattern of one would be highly disturbed when transmitting from the other. The other antenna is a piece of wire that's very small in cross section. Very little disturbance. A little bit of difference in standing wave ratio. Easy to compensate. Almost no change in antenna pattern. Almost no change in gain. That's not the mechanism that happens when antennas are close. The one exception to this is antennas that have real physical area, a horn or a dish. If I've got a pair of 3-foot diameter dishes, parabolic dish antennas, both aimed north, and I want to stack them 1 foot apart, obviously the physical area of each 3-foot diameter dish is overlapping by 2 feet with the other dish. And now you can see the amount of disturbance of pattern and whatever with real physical area type antennas. But antennas that have got large physical, large electronic area, like Yagi antennas, and the areas overlap, it's not the overlapping area that hurts you. It's the capacitive coupling that detunes the elements, and you can retune them. Okay, I think the question maybe was Joe, to B2RYY, but I'm not sure. Person saying question, go right ahead. Wait for the four beeps, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good. Yes, it is W-H-4-Y-Y. All right. Say in a case like that, the filter is able to knock down your fundamental frequency by 60 decibels and not... what would you do or what would happen with the transmitter noise being produced out of band? And say even at 1 megahertz away, the transmitter noise was 100 minus 120 dBc. Okay? And you're putting out 100 watts of power, that's plus 50 dBm. You're going to add 120 dB, now you're putting transmitter noise out on frequency B at minus 70 dBm. Am I correct or incorrect in thinking about that? Even though you're simply your fundamental frequency by 60 dB, what about your transmitter noise elsewhere?
Very smart, Joe. That's the next level of degradation when things are very close. Somewhat similar to the so-called scratchies you get on a defective station master. An effective station master antenna is one where the solder joins between the individual sections inside of that radome, because it's been bending back and forth in the wind, the solder joints are starting to break apart. And so you're getting an extremely small amount of detuning. In other words, the antenna is jumping from a 50-ohm load to a 51-ohm load as the joints move a little bit. But it's happening at a very fast rate. In other words, the rise time of the connection and disconnection as the antenna waves in the breeze is in microseconds. Therefore, the very tiny amount of amplitude modulation created by the scratchies creates a band of noise that spreads out for a couple of megacycles. You've got the world's best duplexing filter on your repeater, so that you've got 120 dB of no at the receiver port on the transmit frequency. You've got this very deep no, therefore no cross-coupling, no desensitization of this repeater. Let me drop. And the scratchies come along making amplitude sidebands that go up easily 600 kc away with quite a bit of power. So therefore, by a crazy coupling characteristic through the antenna itself, it's picking up a signal at the receiver frequency, and the filter can't filter that out because it's on the receiver frequency, if you know what I mean. So you get desensitization. You ran into that exact same problem, Joe, when you once mounted an antenna on a chain link fence, because it was a very convenient physical device you could mount the antenna to proceed with your test. But the chain link fence has got a zillion scratchy contacts between all those wires that are woven in between each other. They're all making a scratchy contact when the wind blows, and you saw some tremendous desensitization of a repeater and a repeater antenna mounted on a chain link fence, the so-called rusty bolt problem. If there's a rusty bolt on a piece of electronics within a few feet of my station master antenna mounted on the top of this building, periodically my repeater is going to be desensitized by the scratchy contact of that rusty bolt when the wind blows. So you're absolutely right, Joe. That's the next level of worrying. You'd have to use extra filtering and whatever, and or to make sure that the spectral purity side lobes... Let me drop. What Joe is into here is that if you've got the right kind of laboratory instrumentation, every oscillator in the world has an extremely small amount of amplitude and phase and frequency modulation. You look at the signal coming out of a perfect oscillator, the world's best crystal oscillator, and it was going into the world's best spectrum analyzer. There should be one simple vertical line on the screen and nothing else. In the real world, every oscillator has got a small amount of residual modulation. So every oscillator displayed on a spectrum analyzer is going to look like the side view of a hill. You've got the spike in the middle, the main frequency, but you've got these noise sidebands falling off at 6, 9, and 12 dB per octave, and they're rated in dBc per hertz, decibels down from the main signal, measured in a 1 hertz bandwidth. That's the way that the industry measures those noise sidebands. So when you've got these very close antennas, the noise sidebands of your first transmitter, if you're not controlling them by some other means, they're going to give you some amount of desensitization of the adjacent receiver. And that's a calculatable thing, and you can decide that if I mount the two antennas 2 feet apart, I get this amount of desensitization. If I mount them 4 feet apart, I get this amount of desensitization, and so on. So it's the next level of concern, and you're right on target, Joe. To B2LYY, K2IW and TechNet.
Okay, well, you were over that station. You witnessed exactly what I was doing. I was putting out a low-level signal on one antenna and transmitting off another antenna and listening to the receiver port of that receiver. And you can hear the descents as you move the chain link fence. But if you also remember what I noticed, that when I moved the garage door up and down and that metal structure changed in position, I also got descents. Here would be a third question discussing something like this. How would you go about finding something like that? Because it's not coming from the transmitting antenna, and it's not coming from the receiving antenna. It's being radiated to the receiving antenna. the antenna strings that you're receiving, but it's someplace else. How would you find that if it's in a near field? In the case with me, between my transmitting antenna and the garage door, maybe it's about 40 linear feet. Maybe another 25 linear feet out to the receiving antenna or the antenna under test. So how would you go about finding something like that? In the real world, you could have that happen on top of a high-density comm site like you're using right now.
Yeah, if you're asking for what kind of instrumentation can find a rusty bolt extra noise generator on the adjacent sidebands of a nearby transmitter falling into the nearby receiver, how do you find that? By hiring somebody who has a lot of experience, who knows how to look at the environment. A person in your environment with enough experience, like you, knows that that garage door has got a bunch of sliding pieces of metal as you move the garage door, and it's got a large effective capture area, it's got a large reflecting characteristic to it, and it can give you a lot of grief. So a tuned eye of a smart person with experience knows how to look for these things. If you're asking for laboratory instrumentation to find it, it might not exist. With one slight exception, you could use radar techniques. In other words, by transmitting extremely brief pulses, and I've done this, I've transmitted pulses of less than 1 nanosecond, a quarter of a nanosecond to be exact. In other words, in free space, a 1 nanosecond pulse from beginning to end in free space at the speed of light is only 1 foot long. 1 foot from the leading edge to the trailing edge. Let me drop. If your antenna and rest of the system has enough bandwidth and you transmit very brief pulses, you could then measure the time delay of the scratchy bolt signal you're getting. I didn't say it's easy. So by time delay radar techniques, you could find it. Just like in the anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base, I found the nail and the adapter, metallic objects, that had been dropped into the foam on the floor that was 15 feet away from the airplane, because the signal took 15 nanoseconds to get out to it, another 15 nanoseconds to come back. The echo was 30 nanoseconds late from the reflection of that piece of metal on the floor. And I knew that the thing that I'm looking for is 30 feet away from my transmitter, so to speak. So by time delaying techniques, you could find it. I didn't say it's easy, but the best way to do it is with experience. And by the way, when you mounted that antenna on that chain link fence, and you had this experiment with the garage door, somebody was with you, and you thought it was me. I wasn't there at that time, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW, TechNet.
You're absolutely incorrect. You were there because you pointed out that the chain link things, which I was aware of anyway, you just have had to recall your memory a little harder. You absolutely were there.
If I saw the chain link fence, I would have told you what the problem was. But the chain link fence problem, you described it to us on the TechNet about 4 years ago, so to speak. And that's the first time I heard it, when you described it to us on the TechNet, when you're doing those experiments for antennas that you were mounting at Adirondack Drive, as I remember. Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
No, I was mounting the antennas elsewhere, actually. No, I think it was a time before we were discussing the disposition of a couple of rolls of 7/8 coax cable before you actually picked them up. And you had come over. I'm fairly certain. It's neither here nor there. It really doesn't matter. It's for a good discussion anyway. I just wanted to add that to it about the transmitter noise comment, because that's something that could throw some people thinking that these two filters on each antenna would suck out the opposite frequency, and that would be the end of the day and the end of the story, and you wouldn't have any problems. But there's something else to think about, which would be the transmitter noise from each over the transmitter.
Yeah, when the transmitter has any kind of spurious signal, something by way of its synthesizer, something by way of its superheterodyne mixing and whatever, if a transmitter radiates any amount of signal, even this noise sideband, which falls on the receiver frequency of the other piece of electronics, there's no filter in the world that's going to take that out at the receiver. Could you now filter out that? Yeah, you could put a notch at the transmitter antenna, at the receiver frequency of the other guy. You could put a notch to stop the noise he's transmitting from affecting the other guy. So you just change the place where you do the filtering. So that situation is still a livable situation. You could have fairly noisy transmitters. One transmitter is on 50 megs, one transmitter is on 51 megs. The two antennas are a couple of feet apart. I make sure that the 50 meg transmitter has a notch on its transmitter frequency at 51. The 51 receiver, I make sure the receiver has a notch at 50. So just for the one-way signal, is going to require a pair of notches, one on transmitter, one on receiver. Therefore, I could make that work, Joe. W-H-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, and that's been done, by the way.
Okay, very good. I'm going to go back to listening. I'm actually working on something else right now, but I've got to have it here on the attack net, the radio in the other room. W-H-R-Y-Y.
Okay, AC-2-I-S. So as you can see, Bill, there are various ways that you can place antennas very close to each other, horizontal, vertical stacking. There's no magic wavelength, quarter wave, half wave, and whatever. It's going to give you a magic. The coupling is a function of inverse square law, antenna patterns, cross-polarization, differences in altitude, the amount of coupling or the amount of isolation between antennas is to some degree calculatable. In all cases, it's measurable. Not a very elaborate measurement. To put a signal generator on one and a sensitive receiver like a spectrum analyzer on the other, you can easily measure the amount of isolation, whether the isolation is a quarter of a dB down versus 130 dB down. In either case, you can measure the isolation and know exactly what you're dealing with. But knowing the physical layout of the antennas, their orientation, physical layout, frequencies, vertical displacement, and so on, it is all calculatable with a plus or minus a couple of dB of ambiguity, but this is not rocket science. Radio people have been facing this problem for a zillion years, and some of the smarter ones have developed a whole lot of rules of thumb of what you can get away with and under what conditions can you make it work, depending on how far you have to push the state of the art. AC2IS, K2IW and TechNet.
K2J.
Eric, go ahead and tell us how close you've been able to measure and mount antennas. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out where you have FM radio transmitters, and typically you might have many of them in one particular place. Either we'll use separate antennas, or in many cases they're combined. And even when they're combined, we always put notch filters to the other frequencies there so that we don't wind up with mixing products that we don't want. We do the same thing with multiple antenna systems. K2RIW, K2J.
Eric, at the Empire State Building right now, a number of the broadcast television transmitters are being combined and put into one antenna simultaneously. So what kind of amplitude combiner? Obviously it's a frequency selective amplitude combiner. It's not just a simple power divider that would have a lot of insertion loss. This is a real tuned network, and how much extra effort was required to make sure the various channels, the frequencies, didn't interfere with each other. How difficult was that to do the first time they did it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, today is not difficult at all. The experience of life has been going on for a long time. But actually, most of your FMers are four times square. And there's an entire room where the combiner is, and it's a big room. And think about it. You know, you're talking frequencies from 88 to 108, and each one of them goes into a cavity. And they also can have a lot of power handling capability. And as big as the cavities are, next to them are individual notch filters, which might be almost as big as a cavity. And we're talking big, big things here. As you go up into the UHFs, it gets a little smaller. But because of the power handling capability,
They're physically large, so even though the wavelength is a lot smaller. K2IW, K2J.